Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistant's assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Prime members. Are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
On average, you'll have to wait 31 days to see an OBGYN. And if you're dealing with an infection or outbreak, you know you need care fast. That's where WISP comes in. Connect with a U.S. licensed provider online and pick up safe, effective treatment at your local pharmacy that same day. Plus, get birth control and more delivered in all 50 states. Take control with comprehensive sexual and reproductive care, all from your phone, WISP. That's HelloWISP.com. The waiting room can wait.
The best way to support The Alarmist as we recover from the Eaton fire is to join us on Patreon. Your subscription goes directly to us and helps us continue to make episodes. You can also make a one-time donation to our show by visiting the shop page on our Patreon. Link will be in the show notes. We appreciate The Alarmy during this time. Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we're speaking with guest expert, Professor Ahmed Mushfiq Mubarak. Dr. Mubarak is a professor of economics at Yale University and the founder and faculty director of the Yale Research Initiative on Innovation and Scale. He has several ongoing research projects in Bangladesh, Sierra Leone, and Nepal, and conducts field experiments exploring ways to induce people in developing countries to adopt technologies or behaviors that are likely to be welfare improving. Let's hear what he has to say about the Bola cyclone. Professor Mubarak, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to get to the Bola cyclone. But first, for context, I was wondering if we could start off with some history on East and West Pakistan and its history with India. I know that this is a lot to cover, but perhaps just an overview of how Pakistan became a nation.
Sure. So British India, which was undivided, you know, the land masses that are currently India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, right? So that was our colonial period. So the British East India Company ruled that South Asia, which is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, for a long time. And then after a mutiny, it was handed over to the British government. And then after World War II, the British were pulling out of their colonies in many different parts of the world, including in India. And that was precipitated by sort of a nonviolent resistance movement led by Mahatma Gandhi, right? Who basically had a campaign of trying to get the British out of India. And Mahatma Gandhi tried very hard to keep India an undivided nation. So India, Pakistan, Bangladesh would have been a single nation. And that required him to, him as well as allies, to negotiate with hundreds of various princely states. So imagine small kingdoms that had to be aggregated together into a nation, right? But it's a very, very diverse country. You know, India today has maybe 80 official languages because every state has its own language, you know, and the languages of southern India are actually a completely different language family than the languages of northern India, which are Sanskrit-based Indo-European languages, right? So this is a hugely diverse country, and one important dimension of that diversity was religion, right? So South Asia had two major religions, Hinduism and Islam, right? And that history hasn't always been pleasant and bloodless. So the religious frictions have always remained. And Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who is often called the father of Pakistan, right? So he wanted a separate nation for Muslims, thinking that as a minority, a pretty sizable minority in undivided India, right, that they would have some disadvantages. And so that's what the sort of the concept of Pakistan came from. Now, what led to a really strange birth of a nation with two land masses, which are two provinces with 1,000 miles apart with a lot of India in between, that came from the fact that simply that those were the two regions with Muslim majority populations, right? It wasn't exclusively Muslim areas, right? So both West Pakistan, which is now Pakistan, had Hindus, right? And East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh, also had a sizable Hindu population, and vice versa, which is India, which what became India, had a sizable Muslim population, right? And so this includes sort of parts of India, like around Hyderabad, which is not contiguous, right? And it would have been inside India. So there were lots of compromises being made on trying to identify the provinces that would have had Muslim majority population, and that led to the creation of this very strange country of West Pakistan, East Pakistan together forming the nation of Pakistan based on religion and religious majority alone, which is, of course, a very strange reason to have to define a country.
And after its formation, the East and the West, what were some of the challenges and the strains that they came across?
I could go on for hours on that. So it was mostly about strains, right? I mean, the really quick and concise way to say it is that, look, the only thing that was common between the two provinces of East and West Pakistan was religion or religious majority, and nothing else was common, right? So if anything, everything was a strain except for the religion, right? And so what made it much worse is that within South Asia, right, as you go sort of further west towards Pakistan, right, the population is different. You know, this is, again, going back to my language comment, Northern European languages, you know, are Indo-European. These were people who were coming down from, you know, only recently a paper in Nature thought that they're people who were coming from or originate from, say, between Eastern Europe to Central Asia, that and they spread both westward and eastward. Whereas there was this sort of native population of India from thousands of years ago, right? And so Bangladeshis or East Pakistanis were sort of a combination of the native early populations with the Indo-Europeans who had come down. Whereas the Pakistan is much more of like sort of northern South Asian descent, so Indo-Europeans. So there are physical differences. So, for example, our skin color in Bangladesh is a little darker than the skin color in Pakistan, right? And height and weight and body shape, etc. They're all, you know, there are ethnic differences, right? And as it's happened many places in the world, these things probably loomed large, right? And so something that, I have known growing up in Bangladesh is that there was a lot of internal racism between West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And that's not just sort of, qualitative information coming from my extended family and friends, right, who had experienced that growing up in first Pakistan and then in Bangladesh. It's also, things that are well documented in history books about the way that Pakistanis spoke about Bengalis, right? And it shows up in the politics as well. So, for example, once Pakistan was formed, you see that the center of power always remained in West Pakistan. The capital was Islamabad, which is in West Pakistan, right? And then that led to lots of other frictions, like most of the investments were happening in West Pakistan, right? And what was, sort of rubbing salt on the wound is that most of the foreign exchange earnings were coming from jute exports, which was one of the main products of East Pakistan, right? So there was a situation where, you know, the source of funds was East Pakistan, but the money was being taken and reinvested in West Pakistan, right? So I think that was a big source of the friction. And there was a group of economists who are Bengali, like from East Pakistan, who then proposed a six-point plan, right? Where they wanted a separate currency, right? They wanted more autonomy, separate governance for East Pakistan, right? And that was one of the big sort of, I would say, landmark events that ultimately led to the birth of Bangladesh, right? This six-point plan. And, you know, you can imagine why the separate currency is going to be useful. If there's this reinvestment happening, then a mm-hmm. separation of currency and economies would have been useful. And then another big landmark event was our language movement, which starts on 21st February 1952, right? So only, what, 6-7 years after the birth of Pakistan. And that movement started because Muhammad Ali Jinnah, you know, that father of Pakistan, he declared that Urdu, the language popular in West Pakistan, would have to be the single unified language of all of Pakistan, right? That would be the official language. But we spoke a very different language. Again, you know, we are 1,000 miles away, right? And people reacted to that. Dhaka University students went on the streets to protest. And on 21st February 1952, there were bullets on those students, right? And that led to a day of remembrance, a language of our language movement that we still I celebrate is not the right word because it's a day of death and sorrow. Mm-hmm. And the United Nations has now declared 21st of February International Mother Language Day in recognition of what happened in Dhaka on February 21, 1952. And that's just coincidentally in 2 days.
Wow. This will be coming out, a little bit after.
Okay. So, we had the language movement, then we had this economic six-point plan that I mentioned, right? So those were sort of the genesis and the sources of some of the frictions and the start of our thinking about more autonomy and independence.
Hey, Prime members, are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh my God, it's the coolest thing ever. Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? Well, check this out. It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic famous foods from restaurants across the country anywhere nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. Seriously. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
This is a mini meditation guided by Bombas. Repeat after me. I'm comfy. Comfy. I'm cozy. Cozy. I have 0 blisters on my toes. Blisters. And that's because I wear Bombas, the softest socks, underwear, and t-shirts that give back. One purchased equals one donated. Now go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile with a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
By 1970, President Yahya Khan has come into power. What is he like as the head of state, and how does he set the stage for this impending disaster?
Yeah. So, one could say that the impending disaster, the Bhola cyclone, which till date remains perhaps the most deadly natural disaster in human history, right? I mean, there might have been earthquakes, so I should say most deadly.
Definitely cyclone.
Right? It led to between an estimated 300,000 to 500,000 deaths, right? So one could say that that disaster was the straw that broke the camel's back, right? But obviously it wasn't a straw. It was something a lot bigger than that, right? And so what happened is, So the cyclone hits East Pakistan, coastal areas of East Pakistan, what's now Bangladesh, right? And there was a lot of devastation, right? And it became clear to the Bengali population, the East Pakistani citizens, that the government of West Pakistan just didn't care, right? And that acted as sort of a focal point to, you know, all this other frustration and anger that had been building about language, about economics, right? And this was sort of the final straw that created a focal point that sort of helped to organize people, right? That ultimately led to a movement. It starts with the election. So just coincidentally, the Pakistan general elections, right, which Yahya Khan called, like, it was going to be the first elections in, you know, because of a series of military governments, right? Going to be the first election in maybe something like 16 years, I might be getting the detail wrong. The Awami League, which is sort of the party that had a strong foundation and identity in East Pakistan, right? So they were affiliated with that 6-point movement of more economic independence and autonomy that I mentioned before, right? So that Awami League and their leader, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, right? So they were campaigning on greater autonomy, right? And once a disaster happens, the Awami League actually responds by providing, you know, some relief, whereas the official response of the Pakistan government was severely lacking, right? Mm. So there are a couple of books that detail some of the events that happened around that time that are worth reading. The one is called The Vortex, which is a fantastic read where two authors, you know, take those events and, you know, create sort of like they fictionalize a little bit, but really they're using sources in order to create the narrative story right behind everything that's happening. And Yahya Khan happens to be one of the major players in that book. And of course, another book, which is more academic research, is called The Blood Telegrams, right, which were written on the basis of a Princeton professor, history professor, takes the telegrams that were sent between Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Yahya Khan, as well as the US ambassador stationed in Dhaka in East Pakistan, right? And Archer Blood was that US ambassador who had been sending telegrams to the State Department and to Henry Kissinger and Nixon, explaining, you know, how bad the situation was in East Pakistan, and he was being ignored. And that's the sort of the source of all the material in that book. So that describes it really well.
In terms of the telegrams, I'm curious about the communication during, actually before the storm, because as the storm is forming in the Bay of Bengal, I'm assuming that the government was receiving a notice that there was a very destructive storm on the way, but these warnings were not relayed to the people. What do you attribute to the lack of communication? How did this mix-up happen?
Yeah, so these warnings were actually coming from what is the antecedent of the National Hurricane Center.
Okay.
In the United States, right? Because they had put up a satellite called ITOS, right? that went up in orbit earlier in 1970, maybe February. I might be getting the month wrong. Okay. So they sent up a satellite, and the satellite was the first sort of with a geosynchronous orbit, so it could send consistent and constant pictures of weather systems forming, right? And in fact, one of the reasons why the U.S. government had put up the satellite is because, remember, this is the Cold War era vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, right? And so they wanted some predictions, not only for hurricanes forming around coastal United States, which is obviously useful for the United States of America, but also hurricanes forming around the globe, right? Or hurricanes, cyclones, typhoons, these sorts of weather events forming, because there was explicit mention of how these could be predictive of political instability, which was going to be really important for the Cold War calculations that the United States had to make relative to the Soviet Union, right? And so, that sort of prediction came true in that this particular cyclone in Bangladesh precipitated the birth of a nation and massive political instability. Right. So the U.S. had this information, right? And of course, it's being relayed. And there were receptors all over South Asia that could have picked it up. But this is actually a surprise. And this is a puzzle that I won't have a good answer for. I don't think anybody had a good answer for as to why we just did not pay attention to the warning signs, right? Because the cyclone actually, ultimately it's called the Bhola cyclone, because Bhola is an island in southern Bangladesh that was the home to lots and lots of people who were affected. In fact, there were some other islands, smaller islands like Manpura, where the devastation was even worse, right? It's just that Bhola was much more well-known as a place. And prior to hitting southern Bangladesh, the cyclone came via sort of the southern coastal areas of India, West Bengal, which is the state just to the west of Bangladesh, right? And there was no warning systems there either. Right? So it's, I think, the best guess, I think if you were to ask experts, is that, systems just weren't in place, right? Mm-hmm. For systematizing the collection and relaying of information. In fact, these types of early warning systems, right, were only, that really we now know helps to prevent mass deaths from natural disasters. In South Asia, they were only put in place within the last, 20, 25 years, right?
Wow.
And in, we had a weather event in 1990 that maybe was one of the, after 1970 was one of the most deadly events, right? And even in 1990, right, we weren't as well prepared, right? People didn't have enough advance warning to move out, et cetera, as we should have been, right? But in 1970, it just seems like systems just weren't in place.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. The message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Prime members, are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever wonder just how good or bad your diet really is? The Mayo Clinic Diet has just launched its new diet score, a game changer in tracking your health. Your diet score is personalized based on tracking key activities that deliver healthy habits, support weight loss, and deliver long-term sustainable success. The Mayo Clinic Diet was developed by doctors and dietitians from the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. It's real foods, no gimmicks or fad diets, just life-changing healthy nutrition. Join today for access to customizable meal plans, tracking tools, group coaching, and at-home workouts. Everything you need for long-term success. Get your free diet score now at mayoclinicdiet.com/go. No sign up needed. Now, the Mayo Clinic Diet accepts the Care Credit credit card. The Mayo Clinic Diet. Healthy weight loss for life.
So we ask all of our guest experts the same question. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it can be a concept that you think is to blame for the massive death toll that was caused by the Ebola cyclone, who or what would that be?
Yeah, I have so many answers, even though I've only had like 2 seconds to think about it. I can give you probably 4 answers.
I would like to hear all of your 4 answers. And if you want, we can then whittle it down to 1.
Yeah. So let me give you the answers that I think other experts might nominate, right? So one person that many people would nominate is Yahya Khan, right? Mm-hmm. Because he was the personification of not caring, right? So there is a famous story of how, you know, so basically he wasn't even visiting East Pakistan, Bangladesh, the site of the disaster, right? For a couple of days, the Pakistan government and army didn't do anything, right? He was actually busy with relaying messages between Nixon and Chairman Mao Zedong in China, right? So he thought his purpose, you know, his big achievement in life would be to help reestablish U.S.-China relations, which Nixon and Kissinger were interested in, but it had to be really hush-hush, right? Because, you know, you don't want to be in a situation, this is a period of really complex global geopolitics, right? You don't want to be in a situation where the U.S. makes an outreach to China and gets rebuffed, okay? And so they were using Yahya Khan because Pakistan was the only country that had relations, you know, and had a direct access to both the U.S. leadership as well as Chinese leadership. So he was busy ferrying between Islamabad and Beijing. And in one of those trips, he just like takes a, coming back from at that time Peking, capital of China, he makes a stop in Dhaka, then goes to the south and does sort of a helicopter ride above the devastation. And note that this is a time when other eyewitness accounts say that there were masses of dead bodies flowing down the rivers. Right. People, I've now met people who were there, who were doing relief efforts, including an American woman who still lives in Massachusetts, who's been, you know, involved in NGO work in Bangladesh for many years. Right. And the stench, I mean, she described the stench as being overwhelming, right, of just massive dead bodies and the stench of death. Right. And Yahya Khan reportedly, you know, takes the helicopter ride and just says, oh, it doesn't look too bad. And then he comes back to, you know, where there are local officials like who were trying to organize relief efforts waiting for him. But he just takes a flight back up to Dhaka, which is north of the site of devastation, because there was a party being organized for him by some socialite in Dhaka. Right? So anyway, Yahya Khan would be one nominee for, you know, your
board
request.
Yes.
You're one nominee for like the evil that
yes
that caused all these deaths. Another nominee would be, I think, you know, a concept, I think, racism, right, between West Pakistanis and East Pakistanis, or between Pakistanis in particular. What Pakistanis will tell you today, like more liberal Pakistanis will tell you today, is the racism displayed by Punjabis from one particular province of Punjab. Right, which is relative to all other provinces. And it wasn't just towards Bengalis. Reportedly, my Pakistani friends tell me that similarly, other ethnicities within Pakistan, like Balochis, like there's other provinces like Sindh and Balochistan, right? They also feel and experience the same type of sort of like looking down, being looked down upon, you know. Not caring about 300 to 500,000 deaths, that requires a level of sort of distancing yourself from another human, right? Which I think, you know, for lack of a better word, I'm calling that racism, right? And surprisingly, you know, even, you know, now this is like 25 years later when I came to the United States and I first had interaction with Pakistanis, right? Who I met in college here, right? And, you know, and based on, I mean, not everybody, like some of my best friends are Pakistani, right? But with one person, it's finally struck me, oh, now I understand what my parents were talking about or what my family was talking about when they told me what situation was like prior to 1971, right? So that's another important nominee, right? And I would say a third nominee is the fact that like the lack of democracy and this tradition of handing over power to the military in Pakistan, which has plagued that country even now, like forget about Bangladesh and East Pakistan, right? The fact that Pakistan has become more and more of a failure as a state relative to peers, right, has a lot to do with really complicated relationship between military and politics and the primary role, the primacy given to the military in political decisions, right? When people in the past, a very good Pakistani economist, Atif Mia, and I, he's at Princeton, we've had sort of online Twitter interactions about, okay, what explains the fact that Bangladesh has jumped ahead, right? So it used to be the case that Bangladesh was much poorer, right? Back when Bangladesh and Pakistan, East and West Pakistan were together. But now the Bangladeshi GDP per capita is easily much higher than Pakistan, right? Mm. The countries have had very different economic trajectories, right? And then when you talk to Pakistanis about that, they say, look, it's because of the army and all of that, and the fact that we've always been focused on defense, right, rather than economic productivity, that's what pushed our country behind, right? So I think that lack of democracy could be another important nominee.
So now I'm asking you, with these three things up on the board, if you had to pick one.
Yeah, I would not pick an individual because, you know, and the reason is I don't think that was pivotal in the sense that if somebody else was in power other than Yahya Khan, would the situation have been different? I suspect not, right? Mm. It would be between sort of the leadership in general embodied by the army, not just one person, right? It's either that or the fact that, you know, that you can only have and maintain such a relationship if your citizens have shared those same beliefs, right? Mm. Which is what I mean by racism, right?
Yes.
So I do think it's if I had one vote to cast, it would be sort of the general perception of Bengalis among Punjabis.
Mm. Yes, it's the leadership backed by the people. Yeah.
So a lot of the story I've been telling are based on sort of historical accounts, narrative accounts, qualitative information, et cetera, right? And that are backed up by good research, you know, a lot of, research using telegrams and papers and, conversations and interviews with people who were present at the time. This is not ancient history. Many of the important actors are still alive and very much interviewable, right? Now, what we've been trying to do is to see whether we can generate any systematic quantitative information and data to test the hypotheses that come out of these narrative accounts, right? So is it really the case that the polar cyclone was a pivotal event that led to the birth of Bangladesh, right? And to do that, you know, I mentioned earlier the ITOS satellite, right? So that was put in orbit sometime in early 1970, right? And then it fails, you know, some of the tape recorders fail in, I think, January of 1971, right? But very luckily, right, it was in orbit exactly during the cyclone, right? And therefore, we have those images on the data of the satellite's observation of the cyclone, right? And with some new scientific methods published in journal Nature, just a couple of years ago, which is sort of allows you to convert, run algorithms to convert those types of satellite images with cloud cover, right? and the sort of the lack of radiation that passes through the cloud cover to make inferences about how intense the cyclone must have been at that particular location, right? So once you have all this information, what you can do is reconstruct how intense the cyclone was in every point in Bangladesh across every single district, right? So now we have a measure of cyclone intensity and how it varies across districts, right? We also have information about voting patterns, right, across districts. And so you can correlate these things using this kind of large sample data. And what you find is that the areas that experience more intense cyclone, the vote share of the Awami League, that separatist party coming from East Pakistan, the vote share for them was much higher. So people more intently went to the polls and voted for the separatist movement when they experienced more of a cyclone. Even and there's another part of the story, which is that we also have data from a World Bank report written in 1970-1971 that tracks, in fact, it was written in 1972, that tracks like how much relief effort happened in various districts in East Pakistan at that time. And what you find is that in the areas where the cyclone was very intense, but they did not receive any relief, that's where the votes were much more intense for the Awami League, right? So when people experienced that, look, a big disaster happened and our government did not respond, right? That led to more of the protest votes towards the Awami League, right? And so that was, so the cyclone, in according to this sort of large sample data, quantitatively, it does seem like the cyclone played a really important role in facilitating sort of the political organization that led to the birth of Bangladesh and the separation of East Pakistan from West Pakistan, right? And then we also observe further to that, now that we have all this information about cyclone intensity across districts, we also know the names and birthplaces of the individuals who took up arms against the Pakistan army during our war of independence, right? And you see that the birthplaces, in the list of birthplaces, the areas that were hit more intensely by the cyclone, those areas are overrepresented in the list of birthplaces of freedom fighters, right? So it not only led to voting, it also led to people taking up arms.
So a direct correlation between the cyclone and the future of Bangladesh.
A direct correlation between the cyclone and political mobilization,
yes,
voting, and even conflict, like taking up arms.
Yes. Wow. That's incredible. Thank you so much for helping us understand this in a way that we just hadn't thought of before.
No, thank you. This is a really important topic. I think it, you know, even though it's a historical event, it teaches us a lot about global geopolitics even today.
And now we're going to head over to Patreon to continue the conversation. If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll be discussing the lost history of composer Joseph Bellone. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.
Ever wondered just how good or bad your diet really is? The Mayo Clinic Diet has just launched its new diet score, a game changer in tracking your health. Your diet score is personalized based on tracking key activities that deliver healthy habits, support weight loss, and deliver long-term sustainable success. The Mayo Clinic Diet was developed by doctors and dietitians from the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. It's real foods, no gimmicks or fad diets, just life-changing healthy nutrition. Join today for access to customizable meal plans, tracking tools, group coaching, and at-home workouts. Everything you need for long-term success. Get your free diet score now at mayoclinicdiet.com/go. No sign up needed. Now, the Mayo Clinic Diet accepts the Care Credit Card. The Mayo Clinic Diet. Healthy weight loss for life.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you haven't noticed, it's winter, and now more than ever, I'm in need of a little treat. That's why I joined First Leaf, a wine club that delivers my favorite types of wine right to my door. Because there's really no better treat than a glass of delicious red, white, or rosé. So go ahead and treat yourself to world-class wines from First Leaf. Go to tryfirstleaf.com/winter to get your first 6 bottles for just $44.95 with free shipping. That's tryfirstleaf.com/winter.
There's one thing that will forever change the way you sleep, and it's the softest 100% organic cotton sheets from Bowl & Branch. You'll fall asleep faster wrapped in the most luxurious comfort. You'll never sleep hot again with sheets that feel breathable to sleep in. You'll experience the purest softness on night one and feel your sheets get even softer with every wash. Discover the difference with 15% off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com with code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.